Welcome to Inside Medical Malpractice. My name is Chris Rokosch. I'm a registered nurse, legal consultant and educator, and the president of Connect Medical Legal Experts. Each month, we'll be looking at the malpractice issues from different perspectives, featuring honest, candid, insightful interviews by people and professionals with a wealth of information to share. Thanks for spending time with me today. Now let's dive into this fascinating subject.
We've got a really great episode lined up for you today. A few days ago, I received an email from someone saying, here's a lawyer that would make the perfect guest on Inside Medical Malpractice. His name is Michael Kaplan. So I took a look and I did a little research and I found out that he was indeed the perfect guest for this podcast. So we connected and talked on the phone. And today, here we are. Before we start talking to Michael, the perfect guest of the day, let me tell you a little bit about who he is. Michael's a senior partner in the New York personal injury and malpractice law firm, DeCaro & Kaplan. They have an emphasis on representing individuals who've sustained a traumatic brain injury and or other catastrophic injuries. He's been selected a New York super lawyer for the past 14 years, named as one of the top 100 trialers in New York State. His firm has been designated a best law firm by U.S. News & World Report. This is impressive stuff. He's a lecturer in law at the George Washington University Law School, where he teaches the only course in the United States devoted to traumatic brain injury law. He was invited by President Obama to be a participant in the 2014 White House Healthy Kids and Safe Sports Concussion Summit. He serves as a member of the American Academy of Neurology Concussion Workgroup. His views and opinions are often sought by well-known news sources, including the New York Times, the Washington Post, USA Today, Gannett News Service, New York Daily News, the National Law Journal, the New York Post, the Huffington Post, ABC, CBS, ESPN, Fox Broadcasting, and NBC News. So I am so excited to talk to Michael today. I know he's got a lot of fascinating things to say, and this podcast will not disappoint. Welcome, Michael.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that very kind introduction.
It's lovely. It's impressive. And I'm sure it's just a little piece of all the things that you've accomplished in your career. Let's start, first of all, by just talking about what got you into the profession of law and how and why you eventually focused your practice on concussion and brain injury.
So that's kind of interesting because I went to college and I thought I wanted to be a physician until I took the course in chemistry. And then I knew that I wasn't going to become a physician. My other passion was politics and political science, and that got me into the study of the law, and I realized that I could help individuals as much as being an attorney as I would have hoped to do as becoming a physician. But I was always interested in the area of medicine that led me, when I first started to practice law, into the area of medical malpractice litigation, which is a fascinating area of the law involving both the law and an understanding of medicine, although you don't need to know too much chemistry in order to do that. And we did that for a number of years. Then a very nice gentleman approached me to represent him in an automobile accident where he was struck head-on by a truck whose brakes failed. And as a result of that, of course, he sustained some very significant physical injuries. And he had a really remarkable recovery from those physical injuries. But he was left with an assortment of problems that were very difficult to understand, because when you looked at him, he looked fine, he sounded fine, but he sustained, in addition to his physical injuries, a significant concussion that left him with a great deal of cognitive problems with his memory, with his impulse control, with his ability to work properly. He was able to return to work, but nobody wanted to work with him. His employer didn't want to give him new tasks. He had problems in his home, managing affairs. And it was something that was very difficult for me as an attorney to understand. It was very difficult for him as an individual to deal with because the world couldn't understand his difficulties. And I was intrigued by it because I believed him. And I asked some individuals who I know in the field of neurology to become involved in his case and educate me in the area of what is now known as traumatic brain injury and what happens to an individual when they sustain a concussion. And it fascinated me. So that led me on to a new journey in working with individuals who have sustained this invisible injury. We call them the silent minority. But the silent minority in the United States now makes up over 5.2 million Americans who have sustained the tragic consequences of a brain injury. And it's a very rewarding area to practice in addition to my work in medical malpractice, because a lot of that, of course, involves people who have sustained a brain injury, unfortunately, from a host of different adverse medical consequences that I'm sure we're going to talk about this afternoon together. So that basically is my journey into the law. It's been almost 40 years now, and it's been a very rewarding and satisfying career.
Well, thank you for telling us that story and for the work that you do. I mean, brain injury and concussion is certainly high in the news right now, and I think the biggest thing for most of us is just the unrealized, I like how you called it the silent epidemic or the silent illness, the unrealized injuries that have happened for years and are just coming to light. So thanks for the good work that you're doing. I personally really appreciate that. Could you move a little bit into talking about, because I mean, we could talk about brain injury forever and it's a fascinating subject, but this is titled Inside Medical Malpractice. So talk a little bit about the crossover between brain injury and malpractice. What are the types of cases you've seen that start out as a diagnosis or misdiagnosis, perhaps a brain injury, that end up becoming a malpractice case?
Well, let's put aside the obvious cases of birth injuries.
Yes.
Because those are horrible injuries involving, for the most part, the lack of oxygen to the unborn child immediately before the birth takes place, failure to do a timely C-section, failure to monitor the expectant mother and watch her fetal heart rate of this child to see if that child is in danger. That's one area that we look at. And that's the most obvious that people might think about when they think of brain injuries and malpractice. But there are many, many other injuries that happen to an individual, brain injuries as a result of medical malpractice. I would say the most prominent being strokes. Where the saying is, time is brain. And when a stroke is not properly diagnosed in the emergency department, if certain conditions that could predictably lead to a stroke are not properly treated, irregular heartbeats in an individual, bleeding from an artery, a carotid or vestibular artery going into the brain, it's called a dissection of those arteries, then that individual has a very good likelihood of developing a stroke. But then what happens to those individuals and to individuals who can sustain a stroke for a variety of other reasons, such as high blood pressure that hasn't been treated. When they go to the emergency department of a hospital, unfortunately, many times the physicians or the other emergency personnel are not quick enough to make the diagnosis of brain injury. I've seen, unfortunately, cases where young males misdiagnosed as having perhaps some kind of a drug problem and not a stroke, because people just are not thinking stroke when they see a young man coming into emergency room, yet that's a large percentage of the individuals who do have a stroke. Other individuals go to the emergency room and there's a delay in bringing a neurologist in for an examination. At other times, we've seen cases where a CAT scan that should be taken before medication is given is not timely given, or we've seen cases even where there's no attendant or technician in the hospital available to do an MRI. So these patients, unfortunately, are sitting there and not getting life-saving medication, something known as TPA, that could really, it's a miracle drug that could not only save their life, but preserve their functioning of their brain. So unfortunately, we see a good deal of that in our practice. We see other instances of brain injuries taking place as a result of anesthesia errors, conditions, lack of oxygen to the brain. Oxygen to the is the food of the brain. And when the brain is starved of that oxygen, it is going to cause brain cells to die. And it doesn't take very long for these cells to die and for significant injuries to take place. So we have seen improper monitoring by anesthesiologists during operations. We have seen patients improperly cleared. We have seen patients starved of oxygen because the tube is placed or the intubation is placed improperly in their esophagus, and it doesn't go into their lungs. It goes into their stomachs, and it's not realized. We have seen a fair share of those type of instances. We've seen brain injuries occur as a result of the failure to properly treat infections. Sinus infections in children that are not properly treated, that and the sinus cavities are very close to the brain, and those infections will then expand and going to the into the brain itself, causing damage to that to the brain. We've seen those cases in malpractice. We've seen pregnant individuals who have a condition known as venous sinus thrombosis, improperly diagnosed and sent home from emergency departments without CAT scans being taken, and they develop brain injuries. So it happens from a host of different areas of malpractice, more than unfortunately you would like to think about. But the brain is a very delicate structure, and it's very easy to damage that brain when predominantly it's deprived of oxygen, known as hypoxia or anoxia. Those are the medical terms. I know the medical terms, but I don't know the chemistry. and inevitably, tragic brain damage will take place.
Well, thanks for that very in-depth look. A couple things. I'm always in awe of speaking to malpractice lawyers about their medical knowledge. I mean, as you know, my background is in nursing and healthcare. And congratulations on learning all that you've had to learn to know what you know right now, to do what you do right now. But man, sometimes doesn't it just seem like we're all lucky to be alive? You know, how is it?
You know, I like to say that hospitals are dangerous places, and I don't think it's good to go to a hospital without having someone there with you to be your advocate, because a lot of things can be prevented if someone is there advocating, a strong advocate on your behalf to make sure that you're getting the care that you're entitled to. You're not ignored. You're not brushed aside as being someone crazy or on drugs or just a hypochondriac. That when you go into a hospital and you make a complaint of a headache, that complaint be taken seriously and be properly investigated before you're allowed to walk out the door. And in medicine, since we're talking about medicine, that's what this podcast is all about. In medicine, there's something known as a differential diagnosis. It's incumbent upon a physician to consider all the possibilities of what's causing your problem and rule out the most deadly and dangerous of those conditions first. And unfortunately, many times in a rush in the practice of medicine, that's not done. The most easiest and the common solution is looked to for the diagnosis. And that's when unfortunate errors take place and people get needlessly injured.
Yes, that's absolutely right. A doctor, on the other hand, might say that it's practicing defensive medicine to rule out the most obvious cause. But I mean, that's a topic that we could debate forever. I mean, to not go with the most obvious cause sometimes, and that it drives up healthcare costs and doesn't necessarily improve outcomes or diagnosis. But I just, you know, recorded a podcast yesterday with a lawyer who had, you know, who has exactly the same view as you. And he ended up in the hospital with some chest pain not too long ago and happened to know the doctor who admitted him in the ER, who probably went a little bit above and beyond and ended up ordering a CT scan that he said, I don't know if this will show anything, but it ended up showing a pulmonary embolus and literally saved his life.
Well,
so,
you know, yeah.
The conundrum of being in healthcare and trying to protect the system, and our systems in the US and Canada, of course, are quite different.
I've seen the same thing happen with a close family member who was taken to the emergency department with abdominal problems, whole host of problems associated with that, and the doctors are doing this, doing that, and doing the other thing. I think you ought to take a CAT scan. Not necessary. A little time goes by. You think you ought to take a CAT scan of his abdomen. They don't do it. Maybe you ought to take a CAT scan, maybe even an ultrasound, because I think he has XYZ. Ah, no, that's impossible. Okay. You're the doctor. I'm just a lawyer. Finally, like by 4 or 5 o'clock in the afternoon, they said, I think we're going to take a CAT scan and an ultrasound. And sure enough, I was right. He had this specific condition. And they said, well, how did you know? I said, well, because I've sued a number of doctors for not taking a CAT scan and ultrasound in these conditions. So, you know, we learn, unfortunately, from the mistakes that the medical profession makes. But when the mistake happens to you, it's not defensive medicine anymore. It's for real. And I, as your guest yesterday must have said, I don't believe in this concept of defensive medicine. I believe there's good medicine and not good medicine. No such thing as defensive medicine.
Well, there you go. He didn't say those exact words, but that's kind of the conclusion we came to. And, you know, just a shout out to the doctors, the challenge of knowing when to order and not to order is, I've worked in obstetrics my entire life. And even knowing exactly when to go for C-section sometimes, I mean, you know, I've been part of a running down the hall to the OR to do a crash C-section hundreds of times, and out comes this perfectly healthy, screaming, pink baby with Apgars of 9 and 10. And it's hard to know, you know, it's just tough to know. But anyway, we're not going to talk too much more about that because that's a subject I could talk about for hours. But let's stay focused on malpractice. And I'd like to just switch things up a little bit because I'm in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, and you're in New York. And a lot of Canadians love to visit New York, including me. And it is, in fact, believe it or not, the state most often visited by Canadians, followed only by Florida and Washington. People tend to come to New York for shorter periods of time than they do to Florida. They often go there and spend a month or two, whereas they might spend 3, 4, 5, 6 nights in New York, seeing the city and doing all there is to do. And no doubt during their stay, no doubt, injuries and hospitalizations and unexpected illnesses happen while they're there in New York. What is your experience with Canadians who are injured in the U.S.? And I'd like to hear a little bit about what are their rights and how does that play out? And how and when have you gotten involved in Canadians who become ill or injured, specifically if there's a malpractice claim?
Well, the first thing that your listeners from Canada have to know is that there is no prohibition for a Canadian citizen to bring a lawsuit in New York or any other state as a result of someone else's negligence that caused their injuries or medical malpractice. And because they are citizens of Canada, we have the luxury of being able to bring the lawsuit, not in the New York State court system, but within the United States District Court system, which is a separate system of courts that will provide justice to them. And they don't have to worry in those courts whether they're going to become hometown, so to speak, that they're from Canada and they're suing a local doctor in Buffalo. And the court is going to, you know, just kind of look at them in some way and weigh everything in favor of the doctor. We could avoid that by bringing that case in the U.S. District Court, where that certainly should never be a concern.
Could you just explain what hometown means? That's a term I've never heard before.
Well, you know, there's a sign in front of every courthouse that only lawyers can read. It's invisible, but lawyers could read, you know, read it. It says, hire local counsel. And hometown means when you're coming in from Canada to Buffalo, you might be hometown there because you're not, you know, one of the locals, one of the boys, so to speak. So that's certainly a concern that's a legitimate concern. So the way to solve that issue is to bring the case, commence the lawsuit in the U.S. District Court. It's called diversity jurisdiction under federal law that allows a non-citizen to bring a case against a resident citizen or company in the U.S. in the federal district court. So now you know that you could bring the case, but now the important thing is to know something called a statute of limitations, because you don't have forever to bring a lawsuit. And for a malpractice case, the statute of limitations is 2.5 years from the time that you were injured or malpracticed upon. And there are exceptions to all of that, but we won't go into the exceptions. But the rule that you should keep in mind is 2.5 years for a malpractice case, 3 years for a regular negligence case. But if it's a death case where somebody died, we'd call that wrongful death, there is a shorter statute of limitations, which is 2 years. So it's important that if you feel that you are thinking of bringing a lawsuit, that you seek a competent legal representation as soon as possible, because that statute of limitations cannot be extended. And it gets even crazier than that, because if you want to be suing a municipality, and that would include a municipal hospital in New York City, it would include the hospitals under the auspices of the Health and Hospitals Corporation, it would include state hospitals. Syracuse, there's a major medical center. I believe there might be one in Buffalo, two that are run by the state of New York. There are shorter statute of limitations that require what's known as a notice of claim to be brought. And for municipalities, which is, it's different for the state, the rule is you have to present a written notice of claim within 90 days. Ooh. 90 days. So if you're discharged from that hospital and you didn't bring file this piece of paper within 90 days, you're out of luck. And very difficult to find a judge to give you an exception to bring the lawsuit. And the lawsuit has to be brought within a year and 90 days, which is even a shorter statute of limitations than what we've been talking about. So it's really important that if you feel that your injury was caused by negligence or malpractice, that you seek a competent attorney as soon as possible. Don't wait.
Well, that That's really good advice and news to me. That, I mean, I would imagine that a lot of people don't even know, perhaps, that they've been injured or that their injuries are due to negligence or malpractice within that 90-day period. You're still just recovering and may still be very ill at that point, depending on what's happened to you. If you had a stroke or a heart attack or a serious injury accident, 90 days.
Well, but it's something that has to be done, unfortunately. But let me just say this as a disclaimer, that what I've given you are the general rules only in New York State. So if your listeners are thinking about this in terms of another state, the rules might be very different in another state. So they can't just assume that they're the same rules in different states as they are in New York.
Got it. Understood. But you are the number one visited state. I just want to say that again. There's a lot of Canadians.
Could, you know, if they need my help in New York, they could certainly go to my website, www.brainlaw.com, and they could get loads of information and my contact information, and I'd be happy to speak to them or chat with them by email if I can help them.
Absolutely. Well, thanks for that. Thanks for that. And that's good. That's good advice and information for people to have who are visiting New York. So another question about, do you have some examples of claims by Canadians that have originated in New York? What types of cases have you seen that ended up as a Canadian citizen or a resident traveling to New York and something happens, it ends up in a malpractice claim?
For malpractice specifically, or I mean, you know, what we say when it comes to brain injury is anytime, anyone, any place. So anyone could have a brain injury from any event in New York, an automobile accident, a fall, an improper construction site, and premises that not properly maintained. Brain injuries can occur in a whole variety of different ways. But unfortunately, when people are here traveling to New York, they do need medical care, emergency medical care, often for conditions that we discuss, such as a stroke or a heart attack, or severe headaches that they're having, because it just can't predict when somebody will have an arterial event or a subarachnoid hemorrhage, something in their brain. Bleeding in their brain, swelling in their brain, it just happens. And when they suffer these headaches that are usually described as the worst headache in my life, that's the term that the patients use to describe that, and they go to a hospital, that could take place in New York as well as in Canada. So we do see this happening, and it happens in a variety of ways, just like it would happen to a resident in New York. There's no different. There's nothing magical about being Canadian and getting malpracticed on in New York. You fall and you break your leg in New York and it's improperly set in a hospital. Bingo. We have a case there that somebody might need my help on. So it's just unpredictable like that, but there's nothing about being a Canadian that's different than being a New Yorker or being a U.S. citizen when it comes to malpractice. doesn't discriminate.
Are you sure? Are you sure there's nothing special about us Canadians?
No, I like Canadians. Nothing. There's nothing special about Canadians and malpractice at all. Sometimes I think Canadians might be a little too patient when it comes to the medical care they expect, because your system is a little different than ours in New York and the United States when it comes to allocating care and times that you might have to wait for certain procedures to be done. But in the U.S., in New York, when you walk into that emergency department, you're entitled to care no matter who you are, no matter how old you are, no matter what your race is, no matter what your nationality is, no matter how much money you have in your pocketbook, regardless of whether or not you have health insurance, you are entitled to quality care, period.
Well, That's good to hear. That's good to hear, because there's a lot of discussion about the differences between our two healthcare systems. Let's shift to that just a little bit, because there's a lot of similarities between our Canadian healthcare system and the US one. Standards of care, causation issues are very, very similar. But there are also some significant differences, as you just mentioned, between healthcare and certainly in malpractice law. You and I talked a little bit earlier, and we both agreed that neither of us are an expert on the cross-border differences between the U.S. and Canadian law. But some of the differences I am aware of is there's a lower threshold compensation for pain and suffering. Punitive damages are rare in malpractice cases. There are differences not in our standards of care, but in how our healthcare is delivered. But so I think rather than you and I trying to be experts in an area that we're not in, what I would love to hear is for you to walk us through from beginning to end the process of a malpractice case in your jurisdiction. Start from the time that the client calls you, emails you, walks through your door, whatever happens, and take us through to the resolution of that. And I'm particularly interested in how you determine damages, because I think that's where some of the biggest differences lie.
Okay.
That's a big question.
That's a lot of ground to cover. So
let's give us the Coles Note version of that.
Let's see how we could do that and get to the area of damages before we lose everybody's attention. So let's start with the proposition that a bad outcome does not mean that there was malpractice. Many people who we consult with, unfortunately, think that they have a case that we could assist them with when upon investigation and hearing a little more about it. Unfortunately, it's something that we can't help them with. And that could be for one of two reasons, because a case involving malpractice involves first what's known as a departure from good and accepted medical care, which then is a proximate cause of someone's injury. So what do I mean by those two things? It means we have to look at a case with a licensed physician in this area of specialty to determine whether or not an individual has a valid claim, because before, when we bring a lawsuit, we have to certify to the court that we've done that, that we've certified that we've looked at the case and consulted with a physician, and based upon that consultation, we believe that the individual has a valid case. So what are we looking at? We're looking at what we know is departures from good and accepted care, that the physician practiced in accordance with his or her specialized training in their field of medicine. And that we need the service of an expert to look at all the medical records to make that determination. But the second question that has to be answered as well is the question of causation, or let's put it in simple English, the question, so what? Suppose let's do this in the simplest way we can. Suppose someone was giving an improper medication. It happens, and that certainly would be malpractice to prescribe an improper drug for someone. But suppose the next morning they wake up and it's excreted from their body and there's nothing happens to them as a result. There's no injury that develops. Well, there was certainly malpractice because they were prescribed an improper medication, but it didn't cause any injury. So that individual would not be, they would be permitted to bring a lawsuit, but they wouldn't be successful in bringing that lawsuit. We have other instances, unfortunately, in cancer cases where the person comes to a doctor with some type of cancer that's not properly diagnosed. But then the question is, well, even if the cancer was properly diagnosed. Not every cancer is, even at this time, amenable to good treatment or a cure. Some types of cancer have carry with them almost certain death sentences, even today. So in those cases, we have to look at the type of cancer it is, the stage it was in when the person went to see the doctor to see if there was a chance for a better outcome or a cure, something that we have to consider. But now we've solved those two issues and the person has a valid claim because they weren't diagnosed properly and with a condition and it's caused an injury to them. Well, now we need to prove that in a courtroom. We need the assistance of expert medical witnesses in that regard who are going to testify on behalf of the patient against another physician, which is not always the easiest thing to find. But that's only half of the equation because now to get to your main question, the damages that they sustain. Well, there are many damages that can happen as a result of someone being injured as a result of malpractice. There could be physical damages, disability that takes place that's compensable. There could be lifelong care that individual needs. We would need to establish that through the testimony of perhaps a life care planner to see what kind of future care and expenses is necessary to tend to that person, whether it's household services they need, medical care that they need, how long they need it, do they need special equipment? All of these things have to be taken into account that could, as I said, could last a lifetime. There are emotional consequences that take place. There's pain and suffering that takes place. And there's also something known in our law as the deprivation of the pleasures and pursuits of life. So what's the difference between pain and suffering and this deprivation of the pleasures and pursuits of life? Well, one is the pain that you are suffering from as a result of your injury, actual physical pain. But what about what's been taken away from you? And what you've been deprived from being able to accomplish and doing. That's another type of injury. That's the mental injury that you're suffering from. That's also compensable under U.S. law, at least the law in the state of New York. Those are two types of injury. And then we have issues of loss of earnings. But it's not only the loss of earnings in terms of the loss that you sustain today. How about the future loss that you're going to sustain? And that's very pertinent when we talk about one of my areas of expertise, traumatic brain injury, when it comes to future loss of earnings. Because if you're injured in a relatively young age in your vocational career, you haven't reached your full earning capacity yet. You're just starting out. I mean, in any profession or any job that you're going to hold, the entry level salary is not going to be as great as the salary that you have after you've acquired a good deal of experience. But with a brain injury, you might be able to return to work. But because of the cognitive difficulties that you are having, memory problems, concentration problems, multitasking, the ability to do more than one thing at the same time, you might not be eligible for a promotion or an increase in responsibilities, and you will be stuck in the same place. You could do your old job, but you can't do a new job. So your future loss of earnings could be very high when we consider the possibilities of career advancement that you can no longer have. That's particularly true for a young person. It's very true for a child. It's somewhat true in different ways for someone who has autistic talents and can't pursue those autistic talents anymore. So these are different elements of damages that we have to consider in these cases and establish through vocational economic experts, through economists, through other individuals to establish these losses that the person might have. And then in cases of death, we have other damages as well. The losses to that family, the economic damages that are sustained because the wage earner is no longer there, that have to be compensated for. So there are a whole different variety of damages that we have to consider, and each one is proved in a very different way.
Well, thanks for that. That was a really insightful and comprehensive view of the things that you have to consider. It's always striking to me that I've always imagined law is a tough profession, and like you couldn't get through your medical chemistry course, I was explaining to someone yesterday that when I first started doing some expert witness work, I thought, oh, I'll become a lawyer if I'm going to do this. I couldn't write the LSAT. I couldn't even get past the LSAT a few years ago. So that settled that soon enough. So I've stayed put where I am. But it's a tough area of law, malpractice. I mean, I think law is tough. And I think malpractice law is tough, maybe one of the toughest of all, because of all of those things that you just described, how serious injury can affect a life and the life of the people around them. What has kept you motivated to keep working in this area?
Well, I like what I do. More than I like what I do, I love what I do. And I feel particularly blessed that I get up every morning and I go to work. Sometimes right now I'm working from my house because of COVID issues. We're working remotely, but I like what I do, and I like helping people, and I like achieving justice for them. And I like being able to provide them with resources in order to get the care that they need and provide information and help to them. It's a very satisfying feeling at the end of the day. And it's a great feeling to be able to walk into a court of law and say, I'm your lawyer. And some people, consider us to be like the Lone Ranger or, you know, gunslingers. But we are sometimes the only or last hope that an individual has for justice. So it's a good feeling to be doing what I do.
Excellent and well said. I think regardless of, your reputation as gunslingers or whatever you want to call it, I don't think there is any one of us who hasn't, when we need a lawyer, hasn't been really grateful for the fights that you fight every single day. And the tougher you are, the better you are, and the deeper and harder you're going to represent us. You know, we're grateful for that. I think there isn't anyone who wouldn't say that. And I try in this podcast to be very respectful to the professions of law and medicine, because, you know, people have things to say about healthcare too, and doctors and nurses. And
I will be the first to say that the medical profession and the nursing profession is an excellent profession, and that they provide usually, mostly, predominantly excellent care. And what we see in what I do are the exceptions, not the rule. What we do shouldn't be a black mark on the entire profession at all.
Yeah, thank you. I know from working in healthcare for 40 years that miracles happen every single day, and 99% of what goes on is fantastic, and babies are born healthy and happy moms go home. And let's just touch, you mentioned COVID and working from home with COVID, and we happen to be recording this podcast early in the year of 2021, when COVID-19 is still very much a thing. And New York, of course, has been an epicenter at different times during this pandemic. From your perspective and your history in concussion and brain injury and malpractice, are there any new issues arising in the world of brain injury because of COVID?
Yes, unfortunately, COVID has focused increasing attention in the area of brain injury and brain damage. It's now being referred to as neuro-COVID or brain fog. Some of the long-term consequences after an individual has achieved a physical recovery from COVID, they are now faced with a whole assortment of cognitive neurological problems that are very similar or in fact identical to the problems that develop or could develop as a result of a traumatic brain injury. There are cognitive problems, memory impairments, concentration problems, multitasking, the ability to do more than one thing at the same time that are impaired. There are physical symptoms that mimic traumatic brain injury, headaches, dizziness, sensitivity to light and sound, something that we were all familiar with with COVID. One of the first signs that develops is the loss of taste and smell. Sleep problems develop. There are emotional and behavioral issues that develop that are identical to those who suffer a traumatic brain injury, depression, other psychological conditions, and behavioral problems, something known as disinhibition, the ability to control your emotions, all can take place now. And this is no longer theoretical or speculative as a result of COVID-19. COVID-19 has been going on long enough now that the medical profession now acknowledges that these problems are real. So as an advocate in what I do, in terms of representing people who have sustained a brain injury, I'm hopeful that more and more resources will be devoted to this issue of the consequences of traumatic brain injury. More resources will be devoted to rehabilitation efforts and to research in this to find a cure for brain injury.
So can I ask you, I have two questions about what you just talked about. The first is, these neurological issues, are they associated with severe cases of COVID, like people who spent 2 weeks in an ICU on a respirator, or are they associated, based on your knowledge, with milder cases as well?
I'm really not able to comment on that. I'm not sure of the answer to that.
Okay, good. That's a good answer then. And the second question I have around that is, you know, I guess looking at the issues that have to be proven in a malpractice case, specifically causation in this case, do you see that these post-COVID issues will translate into medical malpractice cases down the road?
I think they might. They might be because, unfortunately, still, even at this present time, people are not getting properly tested for COVID-19 in nursing homes. If they have COVID-19, they're not properly isolated, and that causes other people to become infected. We don't know if these vaccinations will be properly, and I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the vaccinations, but we know that they have to be kept under some ideal conditions. So if there's negligence in terms of how these vaccinations are maintained, not proper temperatures, vials kept open longer than 4 hours, things of that nature, and people are injected with medication that's not pure or effective, and they get COVID-19, well, they, I believe, have a viable claim and a justifiable complaint to make against the profession who is allowing those things to happen. So, you know, it's kind of early to tell where this all will lead in terms of litigation, but there are certainly different possibilities that I see developing where there can be litigation as a result of this.
So just to be sure that I understand what you just said, you're not necessarily saying that malpractice would be around negligence by the healthcare professions, but more in the treatment of COVID, but more so in the testing, the isolation, the management, and then the, you know, of course, this immunization, which is just in its peak of rollout right now in many countries around the world. But did I understand you correctly there?
That's part of it. But as we could talk more about this, you know, there are conditions that develop to a patient in a hospital, in a rehab facility, such as the Cubid Eye bed sores. Doesn't have to be a patient with COVID. It could be any type of patient in that bed who's not properly turned, who proper hygiene doesn't take place, and they get a bed sore. That would be malpractice. If they're deprived of proper nutrition because they didn't get a proper nutritionist to come in and examine them and make a proper diet for them, and they become dehydrated and then become prone to different other conditions as a result of that. That has nothing to do with COVID. That has to do with poor nursing care, poor medical care at times. So it's related to COVID because COVID is what brought the person into the facility for treatment, but it has nothing to do with the malpractice that develops, that COVID was kind of just the vehicle that brought them into the institution.
Got it. It'll be really interesting, kind of sad, but really interesting to see how this all plays out. Maybe you and I could talk a year from today and just see how it has all panned out. It's, you know, I think we're all watching and waiting and hoping. I have an aunt who I'm a medical decision maker for that's in a long-term care center that's been affected by COVID. I haven't seen her for 9 months and will not get to see her in the foreseeable future. And she's 91 years old. I may never see her again, to be honest. So I've certainly kept my finger on the pulse, in particular on the long-term care situation where there's been so many deaths. So I'm going to be very respectful of your time. I know you have something going on before too long from now, but I have another question that I'd like to ask you, the same question to answer for three different audiences. Our listeners include lawyers and doctors, nurses, healthcare providers, and also the general public. I'd be really interested to hear your answer to this question for each one of those audiences. In your view, what is the most important thing that, we'll start with healthcare providers, what's the most important thing healthcare providers need to know about brain injury and medical malpractice?
Healthcare providers.
Yep.
They have to know that it is a real injury. They have to understand that you don't need to be knocked unconscious in order to have sustained a brain injury. They have to know that a CAT scan or an MRI study are just incapable of oftentimes finding that structural damage as a result of a brain injury because of the microscopic changes that take place, and the fact that these tests are normal doesn't preclude someone from having a brain injury. They have to understand, and this is really important, that individuals with a brain injury need to be treated with compassion and respect, because when they are talking about the problems and difficulties that they're having, even though you can't see them, they're real. So they shouldn't be disrespected in regard to the complaints that they're making to that physician. And that would be my most important advice to the medical profession.
Thank you for that. There's so much learning, I think, that needs to be done. You know, there's so much new knowledge coming out, but some really old knowledge, I think, to unlearn. And new ways of testing to come forward.
But I just want to leave one last thought on all of this. And this is pertinent to you guys in Canada, where you play a lot of hockey, children play a lot of hockey, and also other sports, soccer, and we do the same thing in the U.S. as well as football and baseball and other sporting activities. I like to say, when in doubt, keep them out. So when you have a child or an adult who has a suspected concussion, keep them out of play until they're properly medically cleared to return to play, because we don't want them to go back to play too soon before that first concussion heals. So we have to keep that as rule number one. Keep, when in doubt, keep them out.
Good advice. And you heard it here, folks. So listen, before we wrap up, I want you to answer that question too. For lawyers, let's talk about that. What would you like lawyers to know about brain injury and medical malpractice litigation?
What I'd like them to know is that not every client is right for every lawyer. And not every case is right for every lawyer. That there are a lot of nuances in brain injury litigation that is just not apparent to the average practitioner, even if they do personal injury work or medical malpractice law. Brain injury is a very nuanced area, and they would be doing themselves and their clients a world of good if they associated with an attorney who really understood this complicated area.
There you go, bingo. And that's www.brainlaw.com, correct? Good one. And a third party or a third group of people I'd like you to answer that question for. What's the most important thing that you'd like the general public to know about brain injury and malpractice? You talked about the sports issue and keeping kids out if there's any question. But what else would you like to know the general public to know about brain injury and medical malpractice?
I'd like them to also know that the best cure for a brain injury is prevention. Mm-hmm. That there are many steps that can be taken around the house to prevent brain injuries from happening in young people and elderly people. That's important. That when you ride a bicycle or you're engaged in some other sports, that you go skiing, skate, you wear a helmet. Those are important steps to take. I'd like them to know that if they're not feeling right when it comes to medical issues, suffering from a headache that they've never suffered from before, the worst headache of their life, having headaches when they're not usually prone to headaches, having other neurological signs that they've never had in their life. If they think their loved one has had a stroke, that they get medical care right away. Not to wait till the next day, not to brush it off, but get to an emergency department of a hospital and get evaluated right away. Because as we said earlier, time is brain. So that's the message I'd like to leave with the general public.
There you go. That's good advice. And I think the American Heart Association would agree with you on that. That's really good. So with that, I think we'll wrap it up for today. I just want to thank you so much, Michael. It's been an absolute pleasure talking to you. I could talk to you for another hour or two, but I know you're short on time and perhaps we'll do this again another day. As we mentioned a couple times, if you want to get in touch with Michael or learn more about brain injury, he's at DeCaro & Kaplan in New York. The website's brainlaw.com. They publish a weekly message titled The Brain Injury Insider, some little videos. I had a look at a couple of them today and they were great. So thank you, Michael, and good luck with everything.
Thank you, Chris. I wish you continued good health and safety for you and your loved ones. And I do look forward to coming back on another day and talking some more with you.
Awesome. Take care.
Bye-bye now.